You're listening to Chemistry in Its Element, brought to you by Chemistry World, the magazine of the Royal Society of Chemistry.
For this week's element, we enter the world of science fiction to explore life in outer space. Here's Andrea Seller.
When I was about 12, my friends and I went through a phase of reading science fiction. There were the fantastic worlds of Isaac Asimov, Larry Niven, and Robert Heinlein, involving impossible adventures on mysterious planets. The successes of the Apollo space program at the time only helped us suspend our disbelief. One of the themes I remember from these stories was the idea that alien life forms, often based around the element silicon, abounded elsewhere in the universe. Why silicon? Well, it's often said that elements close to each other in the periodic table share similar properties. And so, seduced by the age-old red herring that carbon is the element of life, the writers selected the element below it, silicon. I was reminded of these readings a couple of weeks ago when I went to see an exhibition of work by a couple of friends of mine. Called Stone Hole, it consisted of stunning panoramic photographs taken at extremely high resolution inside sea caves in Cornwall. As we wandered through the gallery, a thought occurred to me. Could one imagine a world without silicon? Every single photograph is dominated by rocks based on silicon, a powerful reminder of the fact that the element is the second most abundant in the Earth's crust, beaten to first place by oxygen, the element with which it's invariably entangled. Silicate rocks, those in which silicon is surrounded tetrahedrally by four oxygen atoms, exist in an astonishing variety, the differences being determined by how the tetrahedral building blocks link together and what other elements are present to complete the picture. When the tetrahedra link one to the next, one gets a mad tangle of chains looking like an enormous pot of spaghetti, the sorts of structures one gets in ordinary glass and in the mysterious volcanic rock obsidian. The purest of these chain-like materials is silicon dioxide, silica, found quite commonly in nature as the colorless mineral quartz or rock crystal. In good crystalline quartz, the chains are arranged in beautiful helices, and these can all spiral to the left or to the right. And when this happens, the crystals that result are exact mirror images of each other, but not superimposable, like left and right shoes. And to a chemist, these crystals are chiral, a property once thought to be the exclusive property of the element carbon. Chirality, in turn, was imagined to be a fundamental feature of life itself. And yet here it is in the cold, inorganic world of silicon. Most grandiose of all, one can make porous, three-dimensional structures, a bit like molecular honeycombs, particularly in the presence of other tetrahedral linkers based on, say, aluminium. These spectacular materials are called the zeolites, or molecular sieves, and by carefully tailoring the synthetic conditions, one can build materials in which the pores and cavities have well-defined sizes. Now you have a material that can be used like a lobster trap to catch molecules or ions of appropriate size. And if this sounds exotic, it's not. Zeolites make up to half of our washing powders. But what of the element itself? Freeing it from oxygen is tough. It hangs on like grim death and requires brutal conditions. It was Humphrey Davy, the Cornish chemist and showman, who first began to suspect that silica must be a compound, not an element. He applied electric currents to molten alkalis and salts, and to his astonishment and delight, isolated some spectacularly reactive metals, including potassium, and he now moved on to see what potassium itself could do. And passing potassium vapor over some silica, he obtained a dark material that he could then burn and convert back to pure silica. Where he pushed, others followed. In France, Thénard and Gay-Lussac carried out similar experiments using silicon fluoride. Within a couple of years, the great Swedish analyst Jöns Jakob Berzelius had isolated a more substantial amount of the material and declared it an element. Silicon's properties are neither fish nor fowl. Dark gray in color, and with a very glossy, glass-like sheen, it looks like a metal, but is in fact quite a poor conductor of electricity. And there, in many ways, lies the secret of its ultimate success. The problem is that the electrons are trapped, a bit like pieces on a draft board, in which no spaces are free. What makes silicon and other semiconductors special is that it's possible to promote one of the electrons to an empty board, the conduction band, where they can move freely. It's a bit like the three-dimensional chess played by the pointy-eared Dr. Spock in Star Trek. And temperature is crucial. Warming a semiconductor allows some electrons to leap like salmon up to the empty conduction band, and at the same time, the space left behind, known as a hole, can move too. But there's another way to make silicon conduct electricity. It seems perverse, but by deliberately introducing impurities like boron or phosphorus, one can subtly change the electrical behavior of the element. Such tricks lie at the heart of the functioning of the silicon chips that allow you to listen to this podcast. In less than 50 years, silicon has gone from being an intriguing curiosity to being one of the most fundamental elements in our lives. But the question remains, is silicon's importance simply restricted to the mineral world? The prospects do not seem good. Silicate fibers like those in blue asbestos are just the right size to penetrate deep inside the lungs where they pierce and slash the inner lining. And yet, because of its extraordinary structural variability, silicon chemistry has been harnessed by biological systems. Silicate shards lurk in the spines of nettles waiting to score the soft skin of the unwary hiker and inject minuscule amounts of irritant. And in almost unimaginable numbers, delicate silicate structures are grown by the many tiny life forms that lie at the base of marine food chains, the diatoms. Could one therefore find silicon-based aliens somewhere in space? My hunch would probably be not, certainly not as the element. It is far too reactive, and one will always find it associated with oxygen. But even linked with oxygen, it seems unlikely, or at least not under the kinds of mild conditions that we find on Earth. But then again, there's nothing like a surprise to make one think. As the geneticist J.B.S. Haldane put it, the universe is not queerer than we suppose. It is queerer than we can suppose. I live in hope.
So although unlikely, there could be some silicon-based surprises lurking out in space. That was the ever-hopeful Andrea Seller from University College London with the life-forming chemistry of silicon. Now, next week, we hear about frontgenium, the element that we need to get just right.
The idea was to make the nickel ions penetrate the bismuth nucleus so that the two nuclei would fuse together, making a bigger atom. The energy of the collision had to be carefully controlled, because if the nickel ions were not going fast enough, they couldn't overcome the repulsion between the two positive nuclei and would just fly off the bismuth on contact. However, if nickel ions had got too much energy, the resulting compound nucleus would have so much excess energy it could just undergo fission and fall apart. The trick was, like Goldilocks porridge, to be just right, so the fusion of the nuclei would occur just.
And join Simon Cotton to find out how successful collisions were created by the founders of the element Rontgenium in next week's Chemistry in Its Element. Until then, I'm Meera Senthilingam, and thank you for listening.
Chemistry in Its Element is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry and produced by thenakedscientists.com. There's more information and other episodes of Chemistry in Its Element on our website at chemistryworld.org/elements.